And so I'm trying to show Hafez's, I'm trying to bridge the political and the metaphysical, the social and the erotic, and put them together. And so for the Iranians in the audience, I'm not going to read any Persian verses. They're all there. And I'm just going to say number one, and you can glance down on the sheet and see what it is. So you'll know what the verse is. I'll say number one, and then I'll read the English, because I'm more concerned that the non-Persian speakers won't understand what I'm saying than the Iranians, because I'm pretty sure the Iranians and the Persian speakers will. Well, there are a number of stock characters in Hafez's divan: the preacher, the sheikh, the judge, the lawyer, the jurist. And these creatures, these people, evoke his scorn, and they all belong to the exoteric Muslim clergy. And the greatest and most reviled personality, the nightmare obsession of the divan, is the ascetic, the Zahid. And he's the Muslim Pharisee par excellence, and as a universal religious type, he represents what in New England and England in the 16th century down to the 19th was called the Puritan or the formalist. And he's exactly the same as you find in the West at that time. Today we call him fundamentalist. Like the ideologically committed clerics of Saudi Arabia or the hardline Ayatollahs devoted to the mint, anise, and cumin of the Sharia-oriented religion of the Islamic Republic of Iran, in his graceless zeal, this Pharisee ascetic, who is insensible to the erotic, professes a Philistine ignorance of the paradoxes and passions of apophatic theology. Now, his loveless nature is a proverbial theme in Persian poetry from the time of Sana'i, at least. And in Hafez's antinomian verse, you find him single-mindedly dedicated to exposing these Puritans, and I hear whether it's Sheikh, Zahid, Faqih, Wa'iz, Ghazi, Ghazi. These Puritans' lack of practice or knowledge or both of love. And Hafez reproaches him in one place, number one on the Persian. Puritan, if once our witness of divine beauty in earthly form display herself to you, you'd never yearn again for anything but for wine and women. Elsewhere, he says, number two, the sign of the man of God is being a lover. Keep this secret to yourself, since I see no such sign in any of the sheikhs in this town. Benighted in matters of erotic, the ascetic in his gravity takes pride. And the narrow-minded nature of these Puritans is best compared with Angelo, who you will recall is the Pharisaic deputy of the law in Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. The state whereon he has studied has grown sere and tedious. And exactly like the two other stock characters in Hafez's divan, the counselor and the sheikh, the Zahid, who is extroverted in his formalist piety, is full of censorious zeal, dogmatically railing at and cursing his fellow Muslims because they differ from him in ceremonies and phrases. And Hafez pours scorn and ridicule on these types. And he says, number three on the handout, the counselor spoke contemptuously to me. He said, wine is forbidden, period. I agree with you, I said, and also I don't listen to every jackass. The angry sheikh said, go, don't stay here, and give up love. There's no need, brother, for a fight. I simply won't do that. Now, the ascetic is a man of reason, but he's also a fool. And he recalls another character of Shakespeare's Puritans, who is the steward Malvolio in Twelfth Night, who is described as a pedant that keeps a school in the church. And Hafez despises this sanctimonious pretension. And according to his creed of love, he advises, number four in the handout, don't kiss anything except the sweetheart's lip and the cup of wine, Hafez. Friends, it's a grave mistake to kiss the hand held out to you by a Puritan. And so Hafez, one of the central doctrines of his theology of love is the contrast between the mazhab-e-ish, the faith of love, to the desiccated, dry piety of the ascetic, the zahid-e-aqil. And here, he has in mind the type of Puritan who is insensible and ignorant of the higher religion of love, which is one of the main themes of this conference. Number 5 on the handout. The hot brand which we have pressed onto our lunatic hearts is so intense, it would set fire to the straw piles of 100 reasonable ascetics. So in Hafez's higher religion of love, all mortal beauty reflects and exemplifies divine loveliness, since only in the mirror of the former can the latter be contemplated. And I would refer you to number 6 on the handout, where he explains the sacrality of human love and beauty. This is poem number 6 here. And the commentator which I've been using on Hafez, named Lahuri, notes that it is through the forms of mortal beauty, Sovara Hosniye, that God is absolute in reality, attracts the lovers to himself. Anyway, Hafez describes the ascetic as the kafar, as someone who is a kafara esh, and he says, "Go away, ascetics, stop arguing with those who drink the bitter stuff." This is number 6. Because it was precisely this gift the divine ones gave us in pre-eternity. And of course, the bitter stuff, the Dord Kishon, Dord Nushon, the bitter here is the appearance of God in human form. It's there, but it's diluted. It's not the pure beauty. If it were not for his khodbini, his vanity and his conceit, which in Sufi tradition are considered to be the mother of evil, and I'm taking this term from Bahá'u'lláh Khorramshahi, and I'll just quote what Khorramshahi says. Hafez understood hypocrisy to be the mother of all evil, Om al-Fasad, and throughout his life, he thought it his personal duty to struggle against it in all its varieties and shapes, whether cloaked in the robes of members of exoteric legalistic Islam, Ahl al-Shariat, or concealed beneath the garments of Sufi piety. His entire divan is one long manifesto of opposition to religious hypocrisy. So if it weren't for this khodbini, this conceit, he might even be forgiven. But there is no possibility of spiritual knowledge as long as you have a self. And Hafez here follows Attar in viewing the true poet, the true savant, the true aref as selfless. And he says, this is number 9, "As long as you see yourself learned and intellectual, you lodge with idiots. Moreover, if you can stop seeing yourself at all, you'll be free." And here Hafez is versifying a saying by Shah Shuja Kermani concerning the true meaning of love, or fazl. And Shah Shuja Kermani, the famous Sufi, said, "Learned and intellectual folk, ahle fazl, may be said to be more virtuous than other people as long as they do not see their own learning. But once they perceive themselves to be learned or virtuous, they cease to have any virtue at all." Now, this idea of not seeing oneself is explained by Lahuri in his 4-volume commentary by referring to the Roh al-Arva of Ahmed al-Samani, where he notes that Beshul Khafi, the famous Persian Sufi from Merv in Khorasan, came across Khezr in his wandering. And he asked Hez for his prayers, and Hez said to him, "May God conceal your works of obedience for you." And Lahuri explains that in this statement is epitomized the idea, and he quotes this Arabic saying, "How many acts of obedience are iniquity, and how many sins are blessed?" And he concludes, "From this tale, it may be understood that perceiving one's own learning and artistic talent and beholding one's intellectual learning and legal lore inhibits direct realization of visionary gnosis. This is because direct visionary gnosis only occurs in a state of the wayfarer's annihilation of his self, character traits, and individual personality." So when Hafez is attacking the vain ascetic for his egocentricity, his khodbini, or he complains that the town preacher who claims religious convictions and makes a show of faith doesn't have faith and will never become a Muslim as long as he's hypocritical. This is number 10 on your handout. He has in mind both the moral and metaphysical shortcomings of the pharisaical Islamic faith of this imposter. On the moral level, the ascetic vanity, fury, and misplaced zeal is characterized by hubris, insofar as the practitioner of ascetic exercises make a display of their zeal. They turn worship, which should be private and personal, into public exhibitionism, thus leading to the malaise of hypocrisy. Another sort of danger is that the ascetic can actually develop psychic powers, which causes him to fall into the delusion that he's become a member of the sect of the elect saints. And these are very bad spiritual maladies. And Abu Hamed al-Ghazali comments on, in his analogy, in his psychology of analysis of the psychology of the abuse of religious emotions, comments on this, and he says, ascetics, Sufis, and pious devotees are often not without arrogance, and their affliction with this vice can even reach a point that they imagine others are actually obligated to serve them, assuming their own pious devotion obliges everyone else to venerate them. Now that's the moral level. The metaphysical level, the ascetic suffers from amour propre. He is inflated. He has a sense of his self-importance. He cannot transcend the artificial duality between percept and object. He can't see anything beyond me and thee and I and thou. He cannot contemplate the immersion of the part in the whole, the lover in the beloved, the servant in the Lord. Number 11, he doesn't understand between lover and beloved there exists no veil at all. You yourself are your own veil, Hafez. Get out of the way. Hafez scoffs at the arrogance of the ascetic on both the moral and metaphysical level. And the following verse is typical, number 12. Go away, you egotist ascetic. The mystery behind the veil is concealed to the eye of you and me, and occult it shall remain. And I just would like to note here that I disagree with Kharavi's interpretation of this verse in his commentary on the Ghazals of Hafez. And he says the expression manotu refers to the ascetic and Hafez, but it's actually, this refers to the idea of I and thou, me and thee, mine and thine. And I've quoted in my paper verses from Attar, which are exactly on this theme. But in any case, the ethical impediment which prevents the ascetic from piercing behind the veil that Hafez speaks about in that verse 12 is simply that he is sick of self-love, as Shakespeare says of Malvolio in the 12th night, preoccupied with the delusion of his own virtue and moral excellence. And that is one reason why Hafez, from the spiritual station of inspired libertinism, depreciates the Puritan ascetic for his conceit, arrogance, self-centeredness, praising instead the Ren, the inspired libertine, who has transcended these vices. And that, by the way, is a quotation from Nasrullah Porjavadi's wonderful article, Rendia Hafez, where Dr. Porjavadi has really analyzed the psychology of the Rend. I highly recommend his article. It's in his book, Buya John. There are many different people that have written monographs on Rend, but he has actually taken it back to its origin in early Khorasani mysticism. Now, the metaphysical stumbling block to the ascetic's egocentric vision is his false distinction and discrimination of separative personal identities, in other words, you and me. He doesn't yet experience or understand what it means to be drowned in the sea of unity. So, as Shakespeare says of Malvolio, he tastes with a distempered appetite. He is veiled from the mysteries of creation. He is metaphysically and emotionally a polytheist. So from this brief summary, it is clear that the ascetic is synonymous with a kind of undeveloped or degenerate religious piety. He's a Puritan, he's rigid in his exoteric religious persuasion, and he's the polar opposite of the unconventional inspired libertine or rake. He's ill-natured, he's supercilious. Hafez sarcastically counsels him, number 14, don't worry so much about the rogues and rakes, you high-minded Puritans. You know the sins of others will not appear written on your own forehead anyway. And Hafez is here drawing on the verse which I've quoted next to it, number 15, which is from the Divan of Hafez. Here, he's caricaturing the ascetic with the adjective of high-minded. A more literal translation of Zahed Apakize Seresh is pure in nature. But the idea here is that the one who is high-minded, who is pure in nature, is always forgiving, always overlooks other people's faults, and can never by his own nature be censorious. So the ascetic's chief device is his preoccupation with abjui, finding faults in other people. He doesn't cast the beam out of his own eye, but he's content to behold the mote in his brother's. And you find an apt cultural analogy to this in Samuel Butler's work written in the 17th century, The Hudibras, where he's attacking the Presbyterian Puritans of his age. And he writes, he attacks the Puritans, "As if religion were intended for nothing else but being mended, a sect whose chief devotion lies in odd perverse antipathies, in falling out with this and that, with that or this, and finding something still amiss, compound for sins they're inclined to by damning those they have no mind to, still so perverse and opposite as if they worship God for spite." So his critique of these perverse antipathies of the Puritan clerics for finding fault with something that's still amiss is exactly echoed by Hafez in number 16 in your handout, where he scorns the ascetic's penchant for fault finding. "O Lord, this egotistical ascetic whose sights are always fixed on other flaws and faults, cloud the mirror of his mind with the vapor of his sighs." And here Hafez is praying that the sanctimonious ascetic be repaid in kind for his fault finding. And he says, "I hope the hot pall of his hot air, of his religious pronouncements," in other literally the du de ahish, the smoky pall of his sighs, "will befuddle his judgmental vision." And this revulsion for abjui or abini, fault finding in Hafez, is not an idiosyncrasy on his part. It's part of the futuvat tradition which Hafez was immersed in. And I've actually written a whole article in this book on Imam Ali and his attitude towards fault finding. And so you can actually trace Hafez's doctrines back to the first, the fourth Sunni caliph and the first Shiite imam, Imam Ali. And this attitude towards fault finding is reviled in many places, particularly in the Masnavi of Rumi and in Attar. And I've quoted number 18 in your handout, in the verses from the Rumi's Masnavi, which I won't bother to read, but you can read them yourself. The most important verse which encapsulates Hafez's hatred of fault finding is number 17 on your handout. "I said to the master of the tavern, which road is the road of salvation? He lifted his wine and said, not revealing the faults of other people. Or he called for wine and said," whatever. Now, Hafez's master of the tavern, who is the supreme spiritual guide, teaches the doctrine that salvation lies in finding no fault and covering up faults, seeing no evil. And this is exactly Blake's view, where he says mutual forgiveness of each vice, such are the gates of paradise. Now, this verse also, as Taqi Pour Namdarian on his wonderful work on Hafez points out, epitomizes Hafez's perspective on the true human being versus the hypocritical and pretentious religious individual. And Pour Namdarian traces Hafez's moral theology back directly to Attar. And he quotes some verses from Attar's Mante Koter on this matter, which I have in number 19 in the handout, which I'll read from the Dick Davis translation. So you see where this psychology, this moral theology, is coming from. "You seek for faults to censure and suppress and have no time for inward happiness. How can you know God's secret majesty if you look out for sin incessantly? To share his hidden glory, you must learn the other's errors are not your concern. When someone else's failings are defined, what hairs you split but your own? You're blind." In another story, he tells how there's a drunkard who's being carried around in a sack on somebody's back by another drunkard. And he's telling the man through the sack, "You know, I can tell you how to walk straight." And which is, you know, a ridiculous position to be in. He's completely drunk, and he says, "Let me tell you how to walk straight." And Attar says that, you know, if you're going to point out deficiencies in the beloved, then, you know, this is fault finding. And so he says, you have to be a lover. And he says, the reason you see faults is that you're a lover, you're not a lover. And he says, you cannot love, and this is why you seek to find men vicious or depraved or weak. If you could search for love and persevere, the sins of other men would disappear. Now, this fault-finding, this harassment of others, which is done to demonstrate your own virtue and godliness, is the common practice of the false dissemblers of Sharia-oriented piety in Hafez's day and age. But in the canon law of love of Hafez, he says, and this is number 21 on your handout, cause no distress and grief to another, then go and do as you wish. Then go and do as you wish, for in our holy law, no other sin than this exists. Now, this idea that you should cause no distress to anybody else, and then you're fine, you don't have to worry about anything, was adopted by Hafez from the Sufi teachings of Muhammad Balyani, who was the master of the Qazaruni order in Shiraz when Hafez lived. And Hafez praises him in several verses. And he was also the master of Haju Kermani. And you find in the chapter Dar Tark Azadi on avoiding causing distress to others in the Mesbal Hedayeh of Balyani, and I'll quote from it, where Hafez has taken his teachings here in this verse. Sheikh Balyani said, whoever causes distress and annoyance, azar, it's actually the same word used by Hafez to people, proves himself devoid of faith in God. There is no greater sin, again the word guna, you know, that Hafez uses in that verse, than distressing someone's heart, nor is there any more meritorious act of devotion than bringing joy to somebody. Thus Abdullah Ansari declared, and that's also on your handout, it's number, I guess, 22. He says, Harchine rahat ne ta'at, harchine azar ne guna. Whatever does not bring comfort to anyone, to someone else, does not comprise obedience or devotion. And whoever does not aggrieve or distress a person does not aggrieve or distress a person is not a sin. Now I want to return to the tongue wagging and the scoffing at faults mentioned in the ghazal I just cited. Now, the castigation of the ascetic, of the libertine, arises from his metaphysically darkened vision. He doesn't understand that God's providence embraces both saint and sinner. Hafez is paraphrasing the Quranic teachings on this matter, particularly I'm referring to the verse, whatever wrong a person commits rests upon himself alone, and no soul laden down with a burden, in other words, afflicted with the sin, shall be made to carry another man's burden, in other words, is responsible for somebody else's wrong. And Hafez says in this regard, number 23, whether I am good or bad is not exactly the point. Go ahead and be who you are. This world we live in is a farm, and each of us weeps our own wheat. Whether we are drunk or sober, each of us is making for the street of the friend. The temple, synagogue, and church, and mosque are all houses of love. Now, what this ascetic lacks is the Sufi virtue of spiritual poverty. And that is why Hafez exalts the humble entreaty of the rake, of the pious rogue, of the libertine, of the sinner, of the miscreant, of the down-and-out homeless beggar over the Quran-thumping Puritan and sanctimonious fundamentalist. Number 24. Some people say that good deeds will earn them a gated house in heaven. Being rakes and natural beggars, a room in the Magian Tavern will be enough for us. Now, there are several points that should be mentioned here. One is, you have here on the lower degree of the spiritual path, you worship God for the sake of heaven, its delights, the heavenly maidens, the fruits, the wine. But for those who are more advanced on the path, the longing for paradise and the exercise of pious deeds and the works of mortification, all of these applies to this realm, this world. They're held to be of little account. The lover and his counterpart, the inspired libertine, the rend, have already entered paradise by virtue of following the higher religion of love, expressed in the symbol of the Magian Tavern here. The ascetic, however, relies on his own efforts in the material realm to imagine what he imagines to be paradise. However, the libertine has long ago abandoned that for the beloved herself. Now, another matter concerns the differing attitudes of the rend and the zahed. the fundamentalist and the inspired libertine. They have different spiritual perspectives regarding action and contemplation. For the ascetic, it's a matter of formal rituals, pious observances, and for the rend, it's a matter of intention of the heart. The former emphasizes interior quality of faith as the basis of spiritual practice, in other words, the inspired libertine, and the fundamentalist, the exterior quantity of works and practices is fundamental. So I'm just going to, these are some of the, this is in terms of spiritual perspective of the two types of religious, the two religious types. And here again, I would refer to Dr. Pourjavadi's article. I've quoted here in my paper from it, but I don't have time to go into it, where he actually talks about the difference between the works of the ascetic versus the works of the libertine. And the works of the libertine are Nazar Bazi, Esh Bazi, and these are the arts, these are the virtues which the libertine has. And there are higher virtues than that of the ascetic. And so Hafez, of course, assigns a negative value to the works of the ascetic. So in Hafez's social ethics, dervish contentment and spiritual poverty are the most highly venerated virtues. And he says, number 25, 26, and 27, do not disparage the weak and skinny. Remember that, you men of wealth, you know the one given the chief seat in the gathering is the sadhu sleeping in the street. You men of power and ways and means, such haughty pride is out of place. Don't let disdain swell your head, since all your vaunted wealth and rank depends in the end upon the will of dervishes. If there's profit in this bazaar, it lies in the contented dervish. Grant me, God, the bliss of contentment and the grace of being a happy dervish. It's interesting that the ascetic, with his pride, is more in danger of having to pay dearly for his pretension then the libertine is in danger of having to pay dearly for his license and his self-indulgence. Number 28. You Puritans on this cold stone floor, you are not safe from the tricks of God's zeal. The distance between the cloister and the Zoroastrian tavern is not all that great. So Hafez refuses to rate the austerity and acts of self-mortification of the ascetic over the rake's licentiousness. And he says they both wait God's final will. And in this regard, he has exactly the same attitude that Alexander Pope did in his Essay on Man, where he said, the good must merit God's special care. But who but God can tell us who they are? And Hafez says, number 29, come, come, the glory of this universal factory will not be made one whit more or less, will not be made one whit more or less through austerity of men like you or debauchery of men like me. Do you like my pronunciation? Or you what he said in English is what I said. What he said in Persian is what he said. Number 29.
Debauchery,
thank you. Very good. The glory of this universal factory will not be made one whit more or less through austerity of men like you or debauchery of folk like me. Now, happiness and bliss in this life and salvation and felicity in the hereafter is only gained through abasement of pride, through humility and self-negation. And that's why Hafez says the inspired libertine is going to partake of God's grace much more than the proud ascetic. Number 30. The ascetic had too much pride. He could never soundly traverse the path. But the rake, by way of humble entreaty and beggary, at last went down to the house of peace. And of course, Darussalam here is paradise, Darussalam Raft, as Dr. Gomshehi said in his introduction. Now, the very anti-clerical and apparently immoral doctrine which Hafez expresses in this verse, which ranks the inspired libertine over the graceless zealot and self-satisfied Puritan, is ultimately traceable back to the parable of the Pharisee and the publican in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 18, verses 10 to 14. And this gospel parable was retold by the Sufis many times. You find it in the Resolei Gusheri, in the Ehyo Lumedin of Ghazali, and especially Hafez is inspired by the Bustan of Sa'di. And I'll read the verses, they're number 31, the ones that I've circled from the Bustan of Sa'di. And you hear Sa'di's contrasting the Puritan and the Puritan ascetic who's proud of his own devotions with the libertine. And he says, and he's talking here about the libertine, "One rent his soul in remorse, seared in conscience, scalded himself with tears, while the other relied on his personal ascetic devotion." I should say the story concerns this cold-hearted, self-satisfied, pretentious prig of an ascetic that saw Jesus walking on the road and says, "Hey, that's my man, I'm going to walk with him." And this publican, who was a drunkard and a good, a very evil person, said, "Oh, I don't even want to be clear near him." But he went to Jesus anyway, and the publican and the Puritan looked at him and said, "What are you doing here?" And this is the dialogue. And Jesus said, "Well, no, let him come close to me." And these are the words of God. God actually judges the two. And Sa'di, at the end of his story, he says, "For one rent his soul in remorse, seared in conscience, scalded himself with tears, while the other relied on his personal ascetic devotion. If he only knew, in the court of the opulent, helplessness excels pride, contrition outshines egotism. The clothes of pride are pretty, but its underwear is filthy. On this threshold, poverty and contrition serve you better than self-adoration or devotion. Godliness and egotism are opposites. It simply doesn't matter whether you're profligate, fortune wasted away, or painstaking ascetic full of vain mortification. The wisest all have their adages, pronounced for posterity. From Sa'di learn one maxim by heart alone. The soul-mortified sinner brooding on God is better than the canting ascetic affecting piety." Now, this takes me directly into, I think, the most controversial aspect of Hafez's theology, which is his theory of sin. And I call this the positive theology of sin, the Raik's positive theology of sin. And I'm following here the lead of Bahadin Horamshoy in his essay, Meile Hafez Begunav, very, very interesting essay that he wrote, the Hafez's inclination towards sin. And I'll just underline some of the fundamental points in that. I'd like to recall the verse number 30 that I cited, which introduces the Raik as sound of faith despite leading a life of unconventional unconventionality, and the contrast with the narrow-minded, canonically correct Puritan, what he considers to be sinful. And this verse, I think, provides us with an introduction into the key elements of his positive theology of the inspired libertine. And so the verse there is, "The ascetic had too much pride, so he could never soundly traverse the path. But the Raik, by way of humble entreaty and beggary, at last went down to the house of peace." Number 30 there. Now, this, on first glance, seems like your typical salvation through sin doctrine, which early translators of Hafez, such as John Payne and Richard Le Gallienne, thought it meant. That was the first interpretation in the end of the 19th century when Hafez was being translated. This is what they thought these verses meant. But this is crass and naive, and it's quite clear once we study Hafez's verse in light of early Islamic ethical teachings. And Lahori, when he's commenting on this verse, goes back to Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, who is asked, what sort of sin causes the devotee to find God, and what sort of devotional obedience causes the devotee to be estranged from God? And the Imam replied, any act of devotional obedience that leads to pride will cause the devotee's estrangement from God, while any sin that culminates in remorse, regret, and shame will result in the devotee's intimate converse and closeness to God. Now, it's quite clear that the main contours of Hafez's unconventional views about sin have their antecedents not only in early Shiite thought, but go back to hadith of the Prophet on this. And Imam Ja'far Sadiq's pronouncement is reflected in a statement by Imam Ali himself, who said, "The sin that grieves you better is better in the sight of God than the virtue that makes you proud. Now, both these sayings convey to us a fundamental and important spiritual message, which by the 11th century saturated the prose and poetry of the Persian Sufi tradition. The message is that vanity and pride are vices far more detrimental to the pursuit of virtues than the common peccadillos, which are defined by literalist Sharia-oriented piety. Yahya ibn Mu'az Razi, in this context, said, "The contrition of sinners is far better than the pompous pretensions and display of piety put on by sanctimonious worshippers." Abu Sa'id was asked, and we heard from Dariush Ashuri this morning that Abu Sa'id was very important in the formulation of this type of thought. He said, "When does a worshiper of God cease to be a devotee? If he sins, does he cease to be a devotee?" And he says, "No. If he's a devotee, agar bande hasna. If he's a devotee, no. The sinning of our father Adam did not cause him to lose rank in God's eyes or cease to be God's devotees. So be a devotee of him and go wherever you are." Archihahikon. Yeah. Be a devotee of him and be wherever you are. Sin accompanied by contrition is certainly better than devotional worship with pride, as can be seen from the fact that Adam exhibited contrition and was saved, and Iblis acted with pride and was damned. And Ansari actually versifies this, and he says, Allahi bi zaram az ta'ati kemara bi oj avarat, mubarak masihati kemara bi oz avarat. I despair of such humble, obedient devotion that makes me proud, but blessed be the sin that makes me beg forgiveness. So this idea that sin is a necessary adjunct to humility, and that you can actually use sin, it goes through the veil of humility and self-abasement up to virtue and felicity, as Shakespeare says, some rise by sin and some by virtue fall. Some rise by sin and some by virtue fall. This is merely the natural elaboration of a common esoteric tradition within early Islamic spirituality. It's no radical innovation on Hafez's part. And in fact, it has antecedents in the Malamati tradition in Khorasan several centuries before him, and it does not come fully armed like Athena from Zeus's head. Of course, in the Quran, there are many descriptions similar to this, where God is described as being all merciful, his mercy embraces all things, God forgives all sin, do not despair of God's mercy. And there's a sacred tradition, my mercy precedes my wrath. So this is also a keynote theme in Hafez's poetry, number 32. "Last night a herald stood in the tavern corner. Drink wine, he cried, for God forgives all sin. Divine forgiveness shall do the trick and beat all odds. For Gabriel sends you glad tidings of comfort and mercy. God's grace is greater than all our sin. But do not speak of this open secret. Be silent." Now, God is characterized by the attribute of Sattar al-Ayub, veiler of faults, concealer of vices, Al-Ghaffar, he is forgiving. And before his forgiveness, all human virtue is trite and insignificant. Number 32, "Don't look with contempt at a drunk like me, for all the vaunted glory of the Sharia cannot be trashed by such small minutia." Again, the same verse I cited earlier. "The glory of this universal factory shall not be made one whit less or more through austerity of men like you or debauchery of folk like me." Now, Khorram Shahi, in this respect, observes, and he's talking here about the Khodbini, the hypocrisy and the egocentricism of the ascetic. He says, "It is clear that Hafez has a deep understanding of sin and its various degrees and types. He knew that the sin most destructive of Islamic piety and most threatening to man is hypocrisy. The moral range of the sin of hypocrisy in this respect he extended broadly to include such vices as self-righteousness, smugness, conceited self-satisfaction, chodra'i, putting on airs, ostentatious displays of ascetic piety, vaunting one's learning, faz frushi, considering oneself to be holy and sacrosanct, bragging and setting stock in one's own acts of pious devotion, superciliousness, mendacity, imposture, deceit, duplicity in one's relation to God and man, cruel lack of feeling, bidardi, being without love and wisdom, and so on. And this, I love this sentence here. It can be definitively affirmed, however, that no one anywhere or any time throughout the history of Islamic civilization has ever gone to battle against hypocrisy with such pugnacity and labored with such zealous determination to uproot this vice as did Hafez. Now, I don't think that this point can actually be overemphasized. Hafez's predominant social attitude is anti-hypocritical. He hated hypocrisy. And the term ruyo riya in Persian implies pious deception and hypocritical exaggeration. And in religious terms, it means pretense and making a sham of faith. And he said this is a far greater evil than consumption of intoxicating beverages. And so he says, number 35, drink wine to sin 100 times alone where no one sees is better than these orisons they offer up for public pious dissimulation. That's for Hafez, yes. The clapping is for Hafez. Number 36, the drinking of wine in which there's no chicanery or putting on an act is better than the cant of phony ascetical piety and its counterfeit devotion set on display. And he says, it's better to be a notorious drunkard than a private hypocrite. Number 37, they say hypocrisy is kosher, but the wine glass is prohibited. What Sufi path is this? What a great government? What holy canon law? What fine faith this all shows us. Now, there are lots of verses like this in Hafez, and I could cite many which are far more outrageous. But here he's clarifying his position in regard to the sanctimony of pedantic Muslim clerics and their public masquerade of enforcing abstention from wine. And he says that open and public consumption of wine is ethically preferable and even morally superior to the stimulation or simulation of abstentiousness on the part of zealous Muslim prohibitionists. And he says, to paraphrase Shakespeare, he prefers the infamy of the honest drunkard to the false facade of those ungracious mullahs who pretend that the primrose path of dalliance they tread is the steep and thorny path to heaven. And he says, number 38, 39, and 40, God-fearing piety and holy duty, leave those to ascetics. To us leave wine and let time decree between the two which one the friend shall choose. I beg your pardon, ascetics. I'll never abandon the lip of the friend nor the bottle of wine. It's these to me that comprise religion. 40, don't kiss anything except the sweetheart's lip and the cup of wine, Hafez. Friends, it's a grave mistake to kiss the hand held out to you by the Puritan. And even if drinking does consist of a fault of character, what harm does it do? Who is really faultless anyway? Number 41. So what if now and then I drink a cup or two of wine? From blood of grapes that wine comes, not from your veins. What kind of vice is this from which these faults and flaws arise? And if it has flaws, well, tell me, where's the faultless man? Now, he elaborates this metaphor of the fiery nature of namocentric Muslim religiosity, which you take love from it, and he compares this to the Sharia-oriented legalism of Muslim Pharisees and ascetics. And he says, this is a fire that shall consume all of faith. Number 42, the fire of ascetic renunciation and hypocrisy will eventually consume the harvest of religion. Hafez, throw off your Sufi robe and go on your way. Now, one of the interesting ideas that Hafez has used is to justify the rake's salvation in this world is what I would call the metaphysical justification of sin. Although he is enchained by eros, he is trapped by love in this world, he understands the exalted degree of spiritual poverty, and he is paradoxically a free spirit who is unfettered by the ties of heaven or hell. And he says, number 44, the beggar on your back street does not have need of any of heaven's eightfold mansions. The captive in your chain is free of both this world and the next. And this metaphysical justification of sin leads him to suggest that paradise is the final fate of sinners rather than the reward of those who are especially pious and good. Behesh joyimost e chodoshenos buro kimostahake keramat gunakarona. Heaven is ordained for us, and paradise our destiny. O theologian, go away, for it's erring sinners who deserve God's generosity. Now, this doesn't mean that any foolish, stupid sinner deserves heaven more than some Gnostic or adept. The word chodoshenos, theologian, here is meant sarcastically, not seriously. It's addressed to this ascetic. And Hafez's poetic theology here is couched in a language subversive to conventional Islamic soteriology, but there are a number of traditions in Islamic thought which actually explain the theological doctrine underpinning this verse. Ghazali says, the Prophet was asked, there are certain devotees who will enter paradise because of committing a sin. The Prophet said, there are certain devotees who will enter paradise because they commit a sin. How can that be? And the Prophet said, the devotee may commit a sin and then feel remorseful about it and so repent of it, thus keeping it before his mind, and he enters paradise. So this I call the metaphysical justification in sin. And there are many hadiths which actually justify this. There's a book written by Ahmad John called Rozatel Mu'azabin. I can never pronounce this. The Sinner's Paradise. The Paradise of Sinners. And there's a verse that Ahmad John uses. There's a whole book just on the idea of salvation through sin. And he says, the saying of the Prophet, if you did not sin, God would have to create another company of sinners to sin that he might forgive them. And Ahmad John writes, you know, a huge amount of pages commenting on this, and I'll just summarize. Can you give me 5 minutes?
Yes, sure.
Yeah. I'll just summarize what he says. He says, gnosis, knowledge is a burning light, and the lamp from which it shines is a burning light, and the Gnostic's chest is the receptacle for that light. So the light of gnosis, the neuromodifat, keeps the Gnostic warm in the same way that the lamp warms up a glass. Just as firewood cannot withstand fire, so sin cannot withstand knowledge. Likewise, just as a lamp is of benefit in the darkness of the night, the lamp of gnosis, or knowledge, also performs its proper service when confronted by the turbidity of sin and the darkness of heretical innovation, bid'at. God Almighty compares gnosis to a fire, that we may know that just as nothing can withstand fire, which burns up everything that is combustible, no sin can resist being consumed by the existence of gnosis. In fact, the more firewood, in other words, the more sin, the higher, hotter, and brighter becomes the fire. Now, I would have to write an entire book to explain this. God has created the Gnostic for the sake of sinning. Guna kardan. As the tradition says, if you did not sin, God would have to create another company of sinners to sin that he might forgive them. And another tradition says, O God, this people of mine sin excessively, rectify them. God sent him this revelation. If they did not sin, I would have to create another community to sin so I could show them mercy. These seeds of mercy are all for the sake of sinners. So when Hafez says, that's what he's talking about. He's referring to that. The more firewood there is, the higher and brighter is its flame. The more combustible the fire is. Now, here the idea is that there's no wisdom or knowledge without sin. One is to the other as fuel is for the fire. And so Hafez, in his poem number 46, which is actually modeled on a ghazal by Nizari Kuistani, and I gave a paper last year comparing Nizari Kohistani to Hafez and showing how Hafez is taken from Nizari Kohistani. Of course, Nizari Kohistani was a far more wild character than Hafez was in his social life. It's interesting that Hafez drew on him so much. Hafez says, "My life is a black book," number 46. "But don't rebuke a drunk like me too much. No human being can ever read the words written on his own forehead. When Hafez's coffin comes by, it'll be all right to follow behind. Although he is a captive of sin, he is on his way to the garden." Now, the Gnostic who sins is led by a higher consciousness. He's led by the perception of the unity of opposites in love. And that's why Hafez says, number 47, "However so much I am steeped in sin in 100 different ways, since I've become acquainted with love, I number myself among the company of those who enjoy God's mercy." I'm not reading the Persian. That's there for you to read. Is that a misprint? Oh, I'm sorry. What did I write here? Thank you very much. Now, love transcends all religious commandments, overrules all sentient illusory and temporal phenomena, cuts through the war ranging between the various scholastic schools of theology and jurisprudence. And Hafez at the Station of Love thus says, number 48, "Let's forgive the 72 sects for all their ridiculous wars and misbehaviors. Because they couldn't take in the path of truth, they took the road of moonshine." Now, to conclude, in order to understand Hafez's views on the vice and virtue of sinners and saints, I think we have to comprehend the interior spiritual sense in which he approached the Quran and Hadith, and apprehend the nuances of his usage of the symbols of the mystical Sufi tradition in which his verse is steeped. If Hafez in his verse inveighs against the fundamentalist Islam of the Puritan Zahed, this is no different from Blake, who cursed and condemned Orthodox Christianity as being Satan's synagogue in his poem, The Everlasting Gospel. "The vision of Christ that thou dost see is my vision's greatest enemy." But Hafez's antinomianism is not simply blasphemy for blasphemy's sake. It is rather put at the service of love. What is profane in his verse is not opposed to the sacred as such. Rather, the stock characters of drunkard, pervert, fazek, rend, are deliberately employed as part of the Malomati and Kalandari lexicon of the profane. To scoff at religious cant and sanctimony, these words are wielded as poetic weapons in his perpetual battle against Islam's own hypocrites and Pharisees. So I think you have to understand that they're based on well-known theoerotic and metaphysical doctrines, and I think there's one verse which summarizes his message, his moral message, behind this apparently antinomian message that he has, and that's the last line there in your handout. "Heart friend, I guide you well along salvation's way, neither vaunt iniquity nor hawk austerity." Thank you.